This is a message by Pastor Mark Fox of Antioch Community Church in Elon, North Carolina. For other sermons from Antioch, you can visit the church website at antiochchurchnc.org. Now, let's turn our hearts to the Word of God.
Well, again, we are in this increasingly depressing book. I don't know how it's been happening with you, but I just going deeper and deeper into depression as we study it. Not really, because we know that God is good and He is a merciful God. And most of the minor prophets included some hope and some encouragement to the people they were prophesying against. And Amos does that, but we have to wait till the very end to hear the good news. The bad news is plentiful. You know, it was Francis Schaeffer who said in the 1970s, the two things that America is into today is affluence and personal peace. Affluence and personal peace. And he said that personal peace meaning a life that's devoid of pain and trouble and grief. And I think we see the same thing happening in Amos in the nation of Israel in the 8th century B.C. This was a long time ago. But the same things are happening there. What Israel has chosen, instead of a life of purity and holiness and righteousness and following after their God, they've chosen a life of affluence and personal peace. And we see that especially described today as we look at the city of Samaria. Well, this is why God sent Amos to speak to them. Samaria is the capital city. It's addressed in this judgment specifically because of two sins, which we're going to discuss today. The self-indulgence of the haves, if you will, and the exploitation of the have-nots. And then we'll finally look at God's judgment. So let's look at these two. The first is self-indulgence of the haves. You may be wondering about the title. Well, I titled this sermon, The Deceitfulness of Riches, because of Jesus' parable of the sower. You know that parable, I hope you're familiar with it. Jesus said to his disciples when they said, "We don't understand this parable." Jesus, what are you talking about? He said, "Do you not understand this parable? How then will you understand all the parables?" And it really is the foundational understanding for unlocking the truth of the gospel, and basically that there are four soils. There's only one seed. The seed is the word, and the word is spread into the hearts of men and women and boys and girls around the world, but only one of those four soils will receive it. You remember the first seed falls along the path. That seed had no chance. What happened to it? What ate it? The birds. Right? You throw seeds out at your house, you watch. There'll be some birds that show up. You put them in a bird feeder, they'll show up. So will the squirrels, but Jesus didn't use the squirrels here. You just have to shoot those guys. No, the birds devoured the seed before it even germinated. And then later Jesus said, that's Satan. Satan comes along and steals the word from the man's heart before it even germinates for the first time. There's no life whatsoever in that seed. Then the next seed is thrown on the rocky ground. No chance. It germinates and it springs up quickly, as some people spring up quickly when they hear the word, but then the sun comes out and the scorching heat, the persecution, if you will, of the troubles and people making fun of you and saying, really, you believe that stuff about Jesus? Then they quickly fall away and there is no life. And then the third seed, and this is what we're talking about here, it falls among the thorns. And it grows up quickly because it's germinated and there seems to be life there, but then the thorns choke it out. It chokes out the life of that seed. And Jesus, in explaining the parable to his disciples, said the seed or the thorns represent the cares of the world. The cares of the world got you down? The deceitfulness of riches. Riches offer promise, don't they? But Jesus said they're deceitful if we run after them, and the desires for other things. Lord, I'm just not happy with my situation here. I want more. I want bigger. I want better. I want different. And if we're not careful, we can watch the life of our walk with Jesus, if we had one at all, be choked out. There's only one good soil, and he said it produces good fruit, 30, 60, 100 fold, which is amazing. He's saying this is the soil that is it receives the word and it accepts the word, and there's fruit that comes as a result. Well, this prophecy against Samaria in Amos 3 is about thorns. which Jesus calls the cares of the world, the deceitfulness of riches, and the desires for other things. The people in Samaria, if you've paid attention in this, as David was reading, or if you studied this week, you'll know that this is a wealthy city. The people in Samaria have amassed great wealth, and as a result of their chasing after that great wealth, not just having great wealth, but putting their faith in great wealth, as a result of that, they have grown degenerate and fleshly to the point that their trust now is in two things, their property and their protection, or if you will, their wealth and their walls. And God says clearly, they will not be protected by their wealth. Look at verse 15, the last verse we read. He said, God says, I will strike the winter house along with the summer house, and the houses of ivory shall perish, and the great houses shall come to an end. Four times he mentions houses. This was the status symbol of choice, to use Dave Ramsey's phrase there. The status symbol of choice for Samaria was to have houses. You know, not just a winter house, you need a summer house. Not just any old house, you need a great house. Not just any old wooden house, you need an ivory house. I can't even imagine an ivory house, what that would look like. I guess it would look like ivory, but it seems a little silly to me. But he mentions that. And look, do we believe that today, that real property, if you will, I know we've got a realtor in here, at least one of them, maybe two. Real property is a safeguard against future troubles. I mean, we hear it all the time, right? People talk about how investment in real estate is the best investment because, you know, as they say, they ain't making any more of that. You know, if you own property, you own something valuable. Now, look, I'm not against owning property. I own some. I think it's great if you can own property. But is that where we put our trust? The people of Samaria had it going on. I mean, the economy was booming in their day. The stock market was at 30,000. I don't know, whatever. And the world was their oyster. And they slept on couches or beds while most of Israel slept on the ground. They didn't lack for a thing. When they got tired of living in their summer house, they moved to their winter house and vice versa. You know, or they moved to their ivory house. I mean, life was good. Life was good in Samaria. I mean, it was good. You talk about affluence, they had it. They just had one teensy little problem. One teensy little problem, which is not really a teensy little problem. It's a huge problem. Who was their problem? God. You see, God showed up. And he sent this little shepherd-turned-prophet guy named Amos. I don't know how little he was. He might have been 6'5". But I imagine Amos is just this wee little guy, you know, that just comes up and says, this is what God says. You know, listen carefully. But he sends Amos to warn them. He says, you know, you like your houses? You like those? Well, God's going to destroy every one of them. They're all coming down. There'll be dust. Your summer house is coming down. Your winter house, your great house, your ivory house. They're all going to be laid low. And again, is it because God is against people owning a home? And God, everybody said, no, of course not. Is God against people having possessions? Everybody said, no. Is God mad at wealthy people, even the filthy rich billionaires? Is God mad at them? No. It's not about how much you have. It's about how much of that has you. It's when the trajectory of our lives moves towards consumption. When we, as we've talked about in this series before, because it typifies what's going on here, when we move from consuming to live to living to consume, then we are in trouble. And we have an enemy, if you will, in God. He is our friend, our Savior, our Father. But when we start moving our affections from Him and His Word over to our stuff, then He becomes our enemy, if you will. He will do whatever it takes to get our attention. So if you are living in that place where you just want the next level, the next tax bracket, the next social status, the next whatever it is, then it's clear that the thorns are around you and they will choke out the life of your walk with Christ. And so this is a warning for all of us. When we begin to feel secure because of our wealth, because of our stuff, then we are already sliding away from God and don't even realize it. You know, wealth can never be our security. It cannot protect our soul. So they were looking for protection in their wealth. And Amos says, God's telling me to tell you it's not there. Your wealth will not protect you. Every house, every possession, everything they held dear would be destroyed. I remember when we traveled with the New Directions, there was one lady, one girl, she's my age, she's a lady. But anyway, she said, Mark, you know, it's all going to burn. She's talking about stuff. You know, well, this guy lost his guitar. Well, it's all going to burn anyway. I mean, that was her phrase. It's all going to burn. And I understand where she's coming from. Everything we hold dear will be destroyed. I like the quote that Micah read on the podcast the other day. Hint, hint, you should be listening. Congregatepodcast.com, a little sameless commercial there. But Muhammad Ali was picked up one time for an event by Billy Graham. And he gets into the car and he says, you know, he said, I'm usually picked up in a limousine. I'm usually picked up in a Mercedes at least. And I'm riding with you in an Oldsmobile. And by the way, I'm usually picked up by somebody who's a driver, not the guy who's organizing the event. I mean, Billy Graham picked up Muhammad Ali in his own car from the airport and took him then to his house. And then he said, I'm usually taking the houses that are, you know, these mansions, they're on 1,000 acres. I imagine that's what you'd have. And he's his house made of wood, you know, his log house. Anyway, it was a great testimony to the simplicity of the life that Billy Graham lived. Could he have lived as a very wealthy man? Oh, yes. Yes. The Billy Graham Evangelistic Association brought in millions of dollars, but Billy Graham never lived that lifestyle because he did not want that to become his focus, his energy, his protection, because it never can be. They would also not be protected by their walls. Verse 11, God says, you see the walls you're so proud of? An adversary shall surround the land and bring down your defenses from you, and your strongholds shall be plundered. Samaria was built on a hill in 925 BC. This is 760 BC, so it was built, what, do the math, 160 years. Is that right? 160 years earlier, something like that. And it was a powerful stronghold because of its location. Remember back in the day before air forces and before artillery and before missiles, then every war was a land war. Who had the advantage in a land war? The high ground, right? The high ground had the advantage, and Samaria was almost impenetrable. But as we know, because of God, nothing is going to be impenetrable as far as God is concerned. The Syrians besieged Samaria in 901 BC. I told you last year that usually an ancient city that was besieged, it was just a matter of time. It was coming down. But Syria besieged Samaria in 901 BC twice in 1 year, and they could not overcome it. So here we are 140 years later, and the wealthy people in Samaria feel like there's no way that anything bad can happen to them. They have affluence, after all. They have personal peace. They have city peace. They've got walls that protect them. They've got strongholds. They've got mighty men of battle, I guess. You know, it doesn't say anything about their men, but we're assuming that they had it going on defensively. Sometimes we Americans think nothing can happen to us, right? I mean, we are the most powerful nation in the world. Look at our walls. Look at our strongholds. Look at our army. Look at our navy, our air force, our marines. I mean, look at us. We cannot be conquered. And that's what all the great empires said, didn't they? That's what they all said. Well, they have affluence. They have personal peace. What else do they need? Well, they need God. They'd forgotten about God. They put their trust in their own devices and their own defenses. You know, one irony here is, remember when the spies went out into the promised land and they came back across, you know, the river, if you will, and they reported to Joshua. They didn't have to cross a river. I'm thinking about before. They're in the wilderness. They reported to Joshua, to Moses about what they'd seen. Remember what the 10 spies were afraid of? They said the people looked like what? Giants. And the defenses, the walls, you may remember this, the 10 spies says in Deuteronomy 1, the cities are great and fortified up to heaven. That seems like a little bit of an exaggeration. What do you think? A little hyperbole there? But what they're saying is, dude, there's no way. Moses, forget about it. There's no way. These guys have walls you would not believe. I don't care how many people we've got. I don't care how tough we think we are. We cannot take them. The irony is that God, after they wandered in the wilderness for 40 years, and they got in there, how did God take Jericho, the mighty city, fortified by these great walls that went all the way up to the heavens? How did those walls come down? What was the impetus for that? Well, basically, it was trumpet blasts, right? I mean, you march around 7 times, 7 days, and then you blow the trumpet, and the walls came down. God says, what are you talking about? You can't take these cities. You're forgetting who God is. And so now here we are, hundreds of years later, and it's the people of God who've built up their strongholds. It's the people of God who've built these walls that they think are impenetrable. And God says, remember Jericho? Well, neither will you be protected by your defenses, your walls, your wealth. They would also not be protected by their religion. Interesting, in verse 14, I know I'm jumping all around here, but that's okay. Verse 14, that on the day I punish Israel for his transgressions, I will punish the altars of Bethel. The people of Samaria worshipped multiple gods. This is evident by the plural word altars. And as we know about the people of Israel at this time, they worshipped, as one of the prophets said, under every green tree and at every high place. They worshipped every god except the only God. And just in case they get into trouble, they still have the altar where they could run in and grab the horns. He says, you know, the horns of the altar shall be cut off and fall to the ground. You remember any instances in the Old Testament when someone ran into the temple and held onto the horns of the altar? The altar had four corners, and there were horn-like protuberances, if you will, from those. And if you were in a lot of trouble and the king was mad at you, then your only hope was to run in and grab the altar and hold on for dear life. That happened with Adonijah. Remember, Adonijah was Solomon's older brother. And before David had died, but David was on his way out, right? He's an old man. He's about to die. Adonijah, the older brother of Solomon, says, I'm the next in line. I'm going to be king. And he starts telling people, I'm king. I'm king. You can call me King Adonijah. Well, this gets back to David. David says, no, he's not. Bathsheba goes in and says, Didn't you say that Solomon? He said, yes. And so Solomon comes in. He anoints Solomon. Now Solomon is officially king. When the word gets out, what does Adonijah do? He runs like a sprinter to the temple and holds on to the altar. Well, when Solomon hears this, Solomon says, if he will show himself a worthy man, not one of his hairs shall fall to the earth. This is his brother he's talking about. But if wickedness is found in him, he shall die. So Adonijah was spared, at least for a while. And then if you read on, you see he makes another run at the throne and he's put to death. So God says to Samaria, don't even try it. Don't even think you're going to be able to run into the temple and grab the horns of the altar. He said, because when you do, they won't be there. I'm going to cut them off. Oh, and if you run to your houses and you think you'll be safe in your ivory palace, it won't be there either. I'm going to destroy it. Oh, and if you hide behind the strongholds of the wall of Samaria, thinking that nobody can touch me here, he said, they won't be there either. You can run, he says, but you can't hide. What happens then to a people, to a nation that becomes consumed with possessions, with that cares only about accumulating more? And we'll get into this next week when he talks about the women of Samaria. They have a special judgment coming against them, the rich women of Samaria. You've got something to look forward to there. But what happens with people, a nation, a family that runs after wealth? Look at verse 10. He says, therefore, thus says the Lord God. I'm sorry, verse 10 says, they do not know how to do right, declares the Lord. It's an epidemic in our nation today, isn't it? If you work around people in the world, as I do at Elon, if you live around people of the world, as you do in your community, no matter where you live, in Alamance County or Guilford County or whatever county you're in, it doesn't matter. There are people all around you that they don't even think to ask what is the right thing to do. The common person in America today, the common person in the world today, is no longer asking the question, what's the right thing to do? And especially in a nation of affluence and personal peace, the question is not, what's the right thing to do? The question is, what's the most expedient thing to do? What's the easiest thing to do? What's the most profitable thing to do? And we're all guilty. We're all guilty of that. And as a nation, we are guilty of that. We have a Supreme Court that's been guilty of that. We have a Congress that is guilty of that. We have a president and the one before him and the one before him and the one before him who have been guilty of that. Not what's the right thing to do, what would be pleasing in the eyes of God. How can I do what is righteous and true, but what's going to get me the next election? What's going to get me that promotion at work? What's going to get me noticed in the community? What's going to get me, you know, that's 5 minutes of fame? I mean, one of the things about these school shootings is that some of what drives these young men who've been doing this is simply because they know they'll be famous. That's a scary, scary situation that we're living in. What's the right thing to do? They weren't asking that. You know, if you go down that road in business, you cut corners on quality. You underpay your employees. You lie to your customers about performance or a warranty or price. You ever dealt with somebody in business like that? Sure we have. We paid, just to throw AT&T under the bus for a minute, we paid for like 8 years for high-speed internet. Well, the idiot that I am, I'm not tech savvy at all, and of course nobody else was checking. We were getting less than a megabyte speed, and we were paying like we were getting, you know, top speed here. And of course, when we finally figured it out and confronted them on it, did they refund our money for all those years we overpaid them? What do you think? They said, we don't pay you for being stupid. We ain't gonna pay you back for doing stupid. You just paid stupid tax. Again, Dave Ram, they didn't say that. I made that up. They just said, we're so sorry, sir. When we do that in our families, no longer ask what's the right thing to do. Well, we decide, you know, our children need things, or they need comfort, or they need fun experiences more than anything else. And we sacrifice doing what is hard sometimes in training and teaching and building character. We sacrifice that so that they can have what we never had. We can do that in our own spiritual growth when we choose to do what's easy and what's convenient in our Bible reading or our prayers or our fellowship with the church or worship or giving or serving or even showing up on Sunday mornings. Don't get me started on showing up on Sunday mornings. But that's an important thing to do. Guys, this is the most important hour of your week because the church is Plan A for God, for the world. He has no other plan. And we are here on Sunday mornings to equip the saints to do the work of ministry. And if we show up only once a month or even twice a month, there's a problem. There's an issue there where we have misplaced priorities. I understand sickness. I understand vacation. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about choosing to do other things because, let's be honest, they're more fun. Hey, I'd rather be at Disney World right now. Not really. I'd rather be here. When we stop asking what's the right thing to do and instead ask what's funnest, funnest is not even a word, what's the most fun, what's the easiest, what's the most expedient, what's more convenient, what's more profitable. You know, if you work 7 days a week, you can make more money. You want to trade that for doing the right thing? I know sometimes people have to work 7 days a week. See how I'm having to qualify everything? As a younger man, I never would have done that. And, you know, half the people left the church. And, you know, you might leave anyway. But Maybe I've learned a few things over the years. Guys, let's stop asking those questions. Let's start asking that one. What's the right thing to do? Because you know what? When we stop asking that question, we're very short step over into, I don't see anything wrong with doing this. Into, I don't see anything wrong with living this way. I hear that in my classroom all the time from my students. Well, it was the self-indulgence of the haves that led to the exploitation of the have-nots. Look at verse 9. This is interesting. Proclaim to the strongholds in Ashdod and to the strongholds in the land of Egypt and say, assemble yourselves on the mountains of Samaria and see the great tumults within her and the oppressed in her midst. What is he saying there? Do you understand? Ashdod was a city of the Philistines. He's saying, hey, you Philistines, and hey, Egypt, pagans, my enemies, come on up here to Samaria. You will not believe what you're going to see in Samaria. God calls on the pagan nations to see the depth of depravity of the people of God in Samaria. Doug Stewart writes, even people long used to living off the labor of others, like Egypt, would be shocked to see the level of exploitation practiced in Samaria. See the great upheaval within her, God says, and see the oppressed in her midst. And then in verse 10, those who don't know how to do right, he said, those, they store up violence and robbery in their strongholds. What does that mean? They store up violence and robbery in their strongholds. The strongholds were their fortresses, were their walls, were their protection. And I think I have a fairly good picture of what was happening there. The people who were the poor and the oppressed people in Samaria were used as slaves to build those fortresses. Have you ever been to that former plantation in Durham? What's it called, Cindy? Stagville Plantation. You should go check that out. It's free. I used to take my writing class over there when we read Uncle Tom's Cabin. It was one of the largest plantations of the South. There were 900 slaves that lived there. But one of the houses, the quarters where the slaves lived, you can see in the bricks that they used to build the chimney, you can see the thumbprints and the fingerprints of the slaves who built that edifice. And I think what he's saying here is that inside the walls is the blood, if you will, and the DNA and the life energy of the people you oppressed to build your fortresses and to build your strongholds to protect you from your enemy. And you forgot about me. The city was built on corruption. And a city or a nation that's built on corruption will be ransacked by God. It's just a matter of time. It's just a matter of time. He says it in verse 11. He's going to send an adversary. An adversary shall surround the land, bring down your defenses. Well, that's exactly what happened in 721 BC. This was before the Babylonians came in. Assyria took the city and destroyed it after a three-year siege. I like this quote. The wheels of God's justice turn slowly, but grind exceedingly fine. So, the self-indulgence of the wealthy led to the exploitation of the weak. And so God says, all right, that's it. I've had it. I'm bringing judgment. Only one life will soon be passed. Only what's done for Christ will last. C.T. Studd said that. Well, as we've already seen in the book of Amos, the judgment of God on disobedient nations involved enemy armies. That's how God judged his people. He brought the enemy to their gates. They will come in, destroy, and plunder. But look at some of the features of this judgment that make it distinctive. You think God has a sense of humor? How many think God has a sense of humor? Raise your hands really high. How many think God never laughs? Raise your hand if God never laughs. Oh, good. Nobody raised their hand. Because you don't know the Bible if you think God never laughs. He laughs when we make our plans, doesn't he? He laughs. God sits in the heaven and he laughs at those pagans who think that they can conquer him. He uses some irony in verse 12. You may not understand this verse because it is different. He says, thus says the Lord, as the shepherd rescues from the mouth of the lion two legs or a piece of an ear, so shall the people of Israel who dwell in Samaria be rescued with the corner of a couch and part of a bed. That's funny right there. God is saying, he's saying here, you remember shepherds many times, they didn't own the sheep. They were stewards. And he was saying that just like a shepherd who loses a sheep or two or seven to a lion, what does he have to do? He has to bring the parts of that sheep, the gnawed legs, if you will, the leftovers, to the owner of the sheep and say, see, look, here's what happened. You can see the marks there. I didn't gnaw that sheep. I mean, I wouldn't do that to your sheep. I mean, yeah, it was a lion. I saw it with my own eyes, right? And he's saying, see, that's how he brings the fragments, because at least there's a fragment left of that poor sheep, his ears left, you know, or one foot. He says, don't worry, Samaria. I'm going to leave you a corner of those couches you love so much. You got at the most posh IKEA store in the world. I mean, I'm going to leave you just a little of that silk pillow that you love to lay your head on at night. I'm going to leave you just a fragment or two of those. It's okay. You'll have something to snuggle up against and think that you can get comfort from that thing. Now, that's one theory he means by that. The other theory is he's saying, I'm going to take this place out, but I'm going to leave a few of you because I'm a God who leaves a remnant. And maybe there were people still in Samaria who had not jettisoned and catapulted God and still believed in him. And he's leaving a remnant of people. We don't know exactly what that means. Then notice God's calls for witnesses. He uses irony, verse 12, then he calls for witnesses in verse 13. He sends out subpoenas, if you will. There's a court case going on, and he says in verse 13, hear and testify against the house of Jacob, declares the Lord God, the God of hosts. That's the first time that Amos uses that term for God, the God of armies, the God of the heavenly armies. God calls for witnesses. The nation is on trial, and all who see what the house of Jacob, God's own people, are doing will testify against them. What's our response? What do we do with this? What do we do with this judgment that God has brought to his own family in the 8th century? What should we do? We should take heed, shouldn't we? We should make sure that we're not living to consume. Always consumed with thoughts of how we can get more, more wealth, more pleasure, more vacations, more of what I want. It means that we should examine our lives and our use of our resources. We all have time and talents and treasures that are not ours. God has entrusted them to us. Does everybody understand here what Paul meant when he said, what do you have that you did not receive? Samaria had forgotten where all of their opulence came from. They thought, oh yeah, I did this. God said, no, you didn't. What do you have that you did not receive? We all have one life. We have one life to steward here on the earth. We saw a testimony this week. If you were able to see the funeral of Billy Graham, if you didn't, find it online and watch every minute of it. And it will bless your heart. It will encourage your faith. But here was a testimony. And Billy Graham wasn't a perfect man by any means. He was a sinner just like everybody in here. But here was a man who stewarded the life, the one life that God gave him. He did not waste it pursuing things. He did not waste it pursuing his own personal peace. He did it pursuing the Lord. Now, you don't have to be an evangelist to pursue the Lord. That's good news for all of us, isn't it? You just have to love the Lord and his word and pursue him in the ways he's given you the ability to do that with your time, your talents, and your resources, your treasures. Paul said, it is required of a steward that one be found faithful. That's what we're looking for. That's what we need. And everybody in here can be faithful. There's no faithful deficit disorder. That doesn't exist. Everybody here can say, I'm going to be faithful. I'm going to be faithful to follow the Lord and to use my life for him. It's going to mean some changes for some of us. It's going to mean some hard decisions for some of us. But I don't think we'll ever be disappointed if we say, Lord, you know what? Whatever time left I have on the earth, I want to use it for you. training my children, loving my wife, loving my coworkers, making friends with the world so that they can see Jesus in me, using my time and my resources, my talents, coming to church so I can be equipped to do that even better, loving the people, my brothers and sisters who are part of this family right now, being a part of that, not missing out. I think we should do that. What do you think?
Thank you for listening to this message by Pastor Mark Fox of Antioch Community Church in Elon, North Carolina. Antioch meets every Sunday for worship at 10 o'clock a.m. at 1600 Powerline Road in Elon. You can download other messages by Pastor Fox at antiochchurch.cc. You can also learn how to order his books or subscribe to his blog at jmarkfox.com.